Paper 9, Section 6, which is old single column, page 103. All right, let's see. So, I guess just remember that we were in the swing of working through the actual mind aspects of the third source and center. So the third main section here on the actual mind aspect of the third source and center. So let's just jump in here.
6, the mind gravity circuit. The third source and center, the universal intelligence, is personally conscious of every mind, every intellect in all creation, and he maintains a personal and perfect contact with all these physical, morontial, and spiritual creatures of mind endowment in the far-flung universes. All these activities of mind are grasped in the absolute mind-gravity circuit which focalizes in the third source and center and is a part of the personal consciousness of the infinite spirit.
Okay, maybe just so we can kind of get ourselves back in the swing here, let's just notice. The third source and center, the universal intelligence, is personally conscious of every mind. And, you know, that's how they italicize mind. They want to make sure that you're not thinking of this in the same way you think of the universal father being personally intelligent personally conscious of our existence. You know, so it's the literal, you know, direct mind fact that the third source and center is personally conscious of. Not so much directly the personality, you know, or the volition. Like, again, we talk about the volitional absolute. It's actually a volitional circuit. You know, that direct consciousness of the Father is tuned into is the volition. Okay, so, the literalness of that mind activity. Now, if it's going to be personally conscious, you know, we need to appreciate some qualification there. And you notice that's why they threw in the parenthetical, every intellect, not every mentality. See, you know, because remember we've pointed out when they use the word intellect, intelligence, they're talking about the higher domains of the mindal energy system. You know, in this context, it's obvious what they're referring to, the aspect that could have, you know, direct identification of a purposing, of a personality to it. You know, so that domain of the mind, that your gift from the Father, your personality, is most immediately identified with, engaged with, that higher intellect part of your mindal energy system. That activity in that mindal domain, the third source and center is personally conscious of that activity. Okay, so that's they want you to start to think very precisely about the difference between the consciousness of the three sources and centers. You don't want to just have them all blurred together. So you're filing down now to a being who is really aware of what kind of forms are taking shape in your mind as a consequence of your personality engaging. Now, in the case of mortals, especially in this world, it's sad to record that there's not much, you know, activity in the mind that is a direct consequence of personality identification. So there's not a lot to see, but the faintest flicker again. You know, again, he's the absolute mind. So he's not judging you by the degree of that activity, just the existence of the activity. He can't, you know, there's no difference in his eye between a tiny measure and a large measure of activity. Activity is activity because it's an existential recognition by the third source and center. And that's why the faintest flicker fact is true. It's purely an issue of whether or not something exists. No matter how small, if it exists, it's equal in the eye of these existential beings. Okay, so all the way down, you know, from directly personal with the first source and center, you know, the more, you know, directly unity-like spiritual with the second source and center, and now down into that higher domain of the mind itself with the third source and center, you have this recognition of the faintest flicker of fact in you. All right, so that's the context. It's in that sense that you're encircuited in a mind-gravity circuit. That aspect that he sees is what's encircuited.
Much as the Father draws all personality to himself and the Son attracts all spiritual reality, so does the conjoint actor exercise a drawing power on all minds. He unqualifiedly dominates and controls the universal mind circuit. All true and genuine intellectual values, all divine thoughts and perfect ideas are unerringly drawn into this absolute circuit of mind. Mind gravity can operate independently of material and spiritual gravity, but wherever and whenever the latter two impinge, mind gravity always functions. When all three are associated, personality gravity may embrace the material creature, physical or morontial, finite or absentite. But irrespective of this, the endowment of mind, even in impersonal beings, qualifies them to think and endows them with consciousness despite the total absence of personality.
Okay, see, so, you know, they're bringing in that qualification. You know, it's one thing for there to be personality recognition on the part of the third source and center. But, you know, it's still the anchor point of all mind. Okay, so, you know, like we mentioned, all the way down to the lowliest, you know, bacterial or whatever, you know, plant phenomena. You know, he is the absolute mind. You know, and if we're talking about teachable mind, you know, not just mechanical mind, you know, that there's thinking, there's consciousness. You know, even if there's no personality, like in an animal.
Selfhood of personality, dignity, human or divine, immortal or potentially immortal, does not, however, originate in either spirit, mind, or matter. It is the bestowal of the universal Father. Neither is the interaction of spirit, mind, and material gravity a prerequisite to the appearance of personality gravity. The Father's circuit may embrace a mind-material being who is unresponsive to spirit gravity, or it may include a mind-spirit being who is unresponsive to material gravity. The operation of personality gravity is always a volitional act of the universal Father. While mind is energy associated in purely material beings and spirit associated in purely spiritual personalities, innumerable orders of personality, including the human, possess minds that are associated with both energy and spirit. The spiritual aspects of creature mind unfailingly respond to the spirit gravity pull of the eternal Son. The material features respond to the gravity urge of the material universe.
Okay. I think most of that is pretty straightforward. We talk about a lot of these issues a lot. You know, they're just making sure you appreciate that there's a lot of different types of beings, entities and whatnot. You know, and there's, so there's this, you know, a spectrum of this phenomenon that we can't even really imagine. But maybe one just little thing to notice. Yeah, you notice how they were right at the beginning of those two paragraphs. They were how they were speaking with some precision, so that to give you one of these little points of an opportunity to recognize the more subtler aspects of things. You know, so they're talking about the Father being the source of personality. You know, it doesn't come out of matter, mind, or spirit. Notice the way they worded that. Now, we often talk about personality as identifying with, engaging a self. And, you know, for most, just, talking about it, that's fine to just speak in that way. But if you want to be very precise, you have to remember what personality is. I mean, personality is this fact that's coming from the existential Father. It has no relationship to time. It's coming from and is of eternity. So if it's going to engage something, it has to engage something like it. Okay? Now, and the self is one thing. You know, for instance, right now you have a material self, a mortal self, an adjutant self. And next you'll have a Maranja self. You'll have a series of Maranja selves, that get shut down, and then you get a new self as you go from mansion world to mansion world. You know, you have, especially right at the beginning here, you have a number of selves that are here today and gone tomorrow. Okay, that's not, doesn't sound like the Father to me, here today and gone tomorrow. You know, if the Father is going to engage something, it has to be like His nature, eternal. Okay? That fact, that the commonality that threads through, that transcends the ephemeral selves, that's the selfhood. Okay? See, and that's the way they're being very precise there. That technically, the personality is not engaging this self that's here today and gone. It's engaging the selfhood that goes on. And it's like, well, where does that come from? How? I mean, did I somehow, push that up into existence, that I have this thread that extends, sort of atemporally from me? I mean, obviously the answer is no, you couldn't do that. You're not a creator being. Now, that's the mother. The mother endows this continuity into self, a selfhood, that is continuous. And so the personality can strike step with that. You know, so the personality, when it engages a self, what it's really seeing is not that self in a moment. It's seeing the ongoingness of that self as a selfhood. That's what it's really engaging, and identifying with. Okay?
You said it comes from the mother?
Right.
It says here it comes from
the Father. No. The personality, a selfhood of personality dignity comes from the Father. But the selfhood itself is a phenomenon of the mother. She's the one, she's the way, remember? Think of that selfhood as that way that Will is identifying with. Okay? And you're a point along that way. You're a self that's a point along that way. And so you, the self, is attempting to strike step with a twofold phenomenon. A will and a way that go on to eternity. There is a way to eternity. She has supplied the way. And if you will, you will reach that eternity. You consecrate your will to the perfect will. And then progressively consecrate your mind to be something that strikes step with that transcendent harmony that is that ongoing selfhood. You know, so another way to think about it, you know, is think of this, you can think of the selfhood as that part of yourself that is consecrated to the harmony of the whole. So it's like the whole, so it's upheld. See, that's so it's an ongoing selfhood. You know, the part of yourself that hasn't yet identified with the harmony of the whole is not upheld, and the fact that it's not is demonstrated when a whole bunch of that dies, you know, or is turned off. You know, when you outgrow your body in the first mansion world or the second mansion world. I mean, there's a whole bunch of that self that's just scaffolding for that moment. It's not, you know, being upheld by this fact that transcends, you know, where you are in the process. Yeah.
I thought one of the things that personality did was it was the organizer of the material domain, the mindful domain, and the spiritual domain.
Right, so that's the other way to think about that.
With the spirit aspect and the adjuster aspect.
Well, the adjuster is a secondary issue, you know, I mean, initially, but initially what that personality is doing is it's the initiator of your ability to do what I was just describing. It's the harmonizing influence.
Self is kind of like the observer of your being.
Well, yeah, I mean the aspect of yourself that is being identified with by the personality, so that you can think of you have a personalized self and a not yet personalized self, and that personalized self, or you know, you could just say the personality, you know, has an objective perspective on that self, like you're saying there, And what, you know, what brings self from here to here? That personality is that harmonizing influence that can take, you know, unorganized mind and coordinate it into something that can strike step with the harmony of the cosmos. It's the harmonizing influence, but it's not the harmony. It's the potential for harmony, but it's not the harmony itself. The harmony itself is the selfhood. The potential for that selfhood is in the personality. And it's like, well, wait a minute. I mean, if the potential for the selfhood is in the personality, and the personality can only strike step with the selfhood, then how does it get started? Right, by grace alone. Remember, I've mentioned this. By grace alone, the mother has to give you an initial harmony thread, an initial thread of supremacy by grace, you know, that you didn't have to consecrate into existence. She gives you an initial thread of grace by grace, and the personality, you know, engages with that thread, and then you build upon that starting point. So the two of them together get it going, and then you need to take the light in cultivating, growing that relationship, actualizing the potential of the personality as a growing thread of harmony, a growing selfhood. And once that selfhood reaches a certain requisite quality, it fuses with the adjuster, and that's.
Did you say the selfhood is the mediator between yourself and your environment, as the collective relationship between physical, mindful, and spiritual.
The selfhood is really just it's the consequence, you know, an ongoing selfhood is a consequence. Personality actualization. you know, the mediator thing, I mean, you know, the self is, it's a mindful self. The, you know, that's what allows you to interact with other organisms and the environment. Mind is what's doing that. You know, and you're, you know, in the sense, okay, your selfhood is part of that mind too. But, you know, we're just, like I'm pointing out, I mean, it's only when you want to think really precisely and understand some finer points that you make this distinction between self and selfhood. I mean, most of the time you can just, you know, roll that together and you don't have to tease it all apart. But just to appreciate the, you know, the detail, that if you don't have that distinction to understand, some things are going to be confusing. So that's why, you know, at key points, you'll notice when they're giving you a very fundamental point, they'll use the selfhood, because technically that's what you want to understand that personality is engaged to, not an ephemeral self, you know, especially a mortal, you know, animal origin self. Okay, anyway. So just, you know, I just wanted you to appreciate that there's a father-mother, you know, synchrony that they're, you know, just alluding to there in passing.
Cosmic mind, when not associated with either energy or spirit, is subject to the gravity demands of neither material nor spiritual circuits. Pure mind is subject only to the universal gravity grasp of the conjoint actor. Pure mind is close of kin to infinite mind, and infinite mind, the theoretical coordinate of the absolutes of spirit and energy, is apparently a law in itself.
Okay, so let me just notice that. And Gene, notice the second to the last word. What's that preposition? There's your in again, see? Okay, notice what they're doing here. Okay, you know, if you just, like, take the parenthetical in there. Okay, so they say, and infinite mind, and then parenthetically, the theoretical coordinate of the absolutes of spirit and energy, and you go, well, wait a minute. Okay, there's the absolute spirit and the absolute of matter. Super additive consequence of the relationship between those two is the absolute mind, just like the title of, you know, two sections back here, section four, not infinite mind. Okay, but they're reminding you, that remember that the third source and center is not just the absolute mind. It is the absolute mind, but in the context of the infinite spirit and the infinite mind. Okay? So the point of that sentence is to think about it, and I notice that preposition. Okay, so the third source and center at a highest level is the infinite mind. And the nucleus of that infinite mind is the absolute mind. But it's one and the same being. The third source and center is both the infinite mind and the absolute mind. Okay? The absolute mind is the law of that mind. It's the absolute anchor point about which everything must conform. It is the law of mind. That absolute mind is in. See? It's a law in itself. The self is the third source and center. The absolute mind is in the infinite mind, and they're one and the same fact. It's a law in itself. And to take it even further with the, you know, the kind of the subtlety of the apparently, okay, just what we were just saying about our basic way that we understand mind as the super additive consequence of the relationship between spirit and matter. Okay, so the infinite mind, it's got to be a super additive consequence. Okay, well, there's the infinite spirit. That's got to be one of them. That's got to be the spirit element. What's the physical element? What's the matter element? The cosmos infinite. Super additive consequence of the relationship between the infinite spirit and the cosmos infinite is the infinite mind. It's like, well, but there is no cosmos infinite in appearance, apparently, okay? Okay, and yet the mind is there. That's the point there. You know, in other words, whoa, that's, to understand that causally, that's really a top-down fact. I mean, you have to be in infinity and have the cosmos infinite in order to understand where the infinite mind comes from. Okay, and that's, and that is far from apparent right now, the fact of the cosmos infinite. Okay. See, so, well, you know, the Isle of Paradise is the pattern of infinity. It's a nucleus of infinity. Okay, so, it's actually a fun little sentence. You know, they kind of purposely made it a little vague just to get you kind of curious and ponder it and think about it. Again, like we mentioned, they've pointed out the fullness of the third source and center is quite hard to wrap your mind around. Because it isn't just the absolute mind. It goes beyond these really, really inscrutable things. All right? Like the infinite spirit, the infinite mother spirit, the infinite mind. Where was it? We had that. Mind is literally an energy. And I was just trying to remember, where was it that they, where they said it that way about, you know, who could have known that was going to happen? Remember, was that right in the preface here or back? I can't remember. I don't know if I can find it. But, you know, you remember when we first started reading about the third source and center, they were expressing that things came together and who could have known, you know, because, you know, so you can... sort of with what you can immediately appreciate, it's like, okay, I've got the absolute of spirit and the absolute of matter. Okay, the absolute mind, okay, that seems... But whoa, where did all of this infinite stuff come from? That's the real out-of-the-blue stuff that they were alluding to. I think we kind of talked about that before.
So it's only theoretical from a bottom-up point of view. From a top...
Well, see, again, see, well, see, that's what I mean. See, you know, directly, I mean, okay, you have the absolute spirit, the absolute matter, and the absolute mind. I mean, that's what, okay, but that they know that's also the infinite mind. And so, okay, now theoretically, there's not something, okay, that's what they're just trying to point out, that you've got something that's really very transcendent of just the absolute stuff. And yet it's the one and the same thing, theoretically, and that's what's so confusing about it. Okay.
Is that thing you were talking about at the very beginning of paper 9?
Yeah, I thought it was.
Nothing, not second sense, nothing in this eternity situation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's right, yeah. A strange thing occurred when in the presence. Yeah, yeah, that's, yeah, it is right at the beginning of 9. Yeah, there it is, yeah, yeah. All right. Right, it's just that it, you know, and again, we've pointed that out. It's from an individuality viewpoint, you know, like they're saying there, it's kind of hard to wrap your mind around. But from when you start to really think from the highest domains of the unity viewpoint, you recognize that there's a whole bunch of stuff going on way up there, you know, that's really above the first source and center. A whole bunch of stuff it's within the Trinity infinite, okay, but, you know, it's not way down there with the absolutes, you know, way down there with the absolutes, okay?
Nearly.
All right. Anyway.
The greater the spirit energy divergence, the greater the observable function of mind. The lesser the diversity of energy and spirit, the lesser the observable function of mind. Apparently, the maximum function of the cosmic mind is in the time universes of space. Here, mind seems to function in a mid-zone between energy and spirit, But this is not true of the higher levels of mind. On Paradise, energy and spirit are essentially one. The mind-gravity circuit is dependable. It emanates from the third person of deity on Paradise. But not all the observable function of mind is predictable. Throughout all known creation, there parallels this circuit of mind some little understood presence whose function is not predictable. We believe that this unpredictability is partly attributable to the function of the Universal Absolute. What this function is, we do not know. What actuates it, we can only conjecture. Concerning its relations to creatures, we can only speculate.
Okay. Now, let's see. Maybe the first just little thing. Let me just toss this little thought out. Okay, so when you look at this chart of the psychic circles in the sevenfold that we always bring up. You know, and we've completed the whole picture by having the cosmic mothers, column here, paralleling the creators and controllers. You know, and we're always talking about, these mothers are domains of mind. So we often think of this as having a lot to do with the whole mind part of the picture. This column, matter and spirit and mind. Notice what's up at the, top. It's in a gray box, and in parentheses in there, a little annotation, as a foundation point for those cosmic mothers. It's not one of the mothers itself, but the foundation. It's we know when we study total deity a little bit that, the fact of the mother stems from the infinite upholder. Reminding yourself that. When you're talking about mind, there's always that foundational fact of the infinite upholder. Remember what they tell you up in deity and reality? When they give you those seven facets of deity, and three of them, they say, now you can kind of think of this as being related to this absolute, and this one is this absolute, and this one. Okay. When you're talking about the Universal Absolute, that's an individuality viewpoint fact. It's one of the seven absolutes of infinity. Okay, this, and from a purely individuality viewpoint, it's just a reservoir for mind energy, the potential for mind energy. Okay, you wouldn't think of that reservoir as functioning. See how they say that? Partly attributed to the function of the Universal Absolute. What functions? Reservoirs don't function. What functions? God's act and deity functions. When they use the word function in a very specific sense, that's what deity, just in and of itself, deity functions. Like, for instance, you can't really say that the Paradise Trinity acts like God acts, but it functions. Just the way they worded it, they're trying to get you to put some pieces together. They have to present it in the individuality viewpoint. They were told to construct this initially with the seven absolutes of infinity as the starting point for your recognition. But when they're having to push into domains where you can't really get at the fact with just the seven absolutes of infinity, they tweak the wording a little bit to get you to, to notice that this is a suggestion for a starting point of thinking about this. So the function of the Universal Absolute. Okay, the Universal Absolute is the bottom-up viewpoint. What do you call that facet of deity when you turn it around and look at it from the unity viewpoint? What's that facet of deity called? It's the Universal Absolute.
God the Absolute.
Clue, we held the infinite upholder. Right? Okay. Now, okay, see, so that's a facet of deity. That functions. And again, what are we talking about here? We're talking about the absolute mind. See, right here, the mind-gravity circuit is dependable. We're talking about the absolute mind and its circuit. Okay, so the absolute, not the infinite mind, the absolute mind. Okay, so if you're going to talk about something that, you know, is striking step with it, like they're indicating here, there's something that parallels this circuit. It's going to have to be, I mean, right there with it as an absolute fact, paralleling it. You downstep the infinite upholder, the first notch, like we've talked about, what do you have? The absolute upholder. From the infinite upholder, you have the absolute upholder. Okay? That mother fact that's tied to God, the absolute. The absolute upholder is the co-absolute mind. So what would strike immediate parallel step with the absolute mind? Perhaps the co-absolute mind, which is the absolute upholder, which is the downstepped expression of the infinite upholder, which is what's actually the functioning. Okay. Just put all the pieces together. Yeah. The co-absolute mind strikes step with the absolute mind in very subtle ways. Okay, like they're saying, not very predictable. Now, this paragraph should have reminded you of something. Remember when we were reading, talking about the second source and center? So if you go back to page 83, which is paper 7, section 1, the second and third to the last paragraphs there of section 1 that are at the top of page 83 in the single column. The one that starts out with but alongside. Let me just read those two paragraphs. Think about the one we just read about the mind. Okay, so here we're talking about the spirit circuit, spirit presence. But alongside this very dependable and predictable function of the spiritual presence of the eternal Son, there are encountered phenomena which are not so predictable in their reactions. Such phenomena probably indicate the coordinate action of the deity absolute in the realms of emerging spiritual potentials. We know that the spirit presence of the eternal Son is the influence of a majestic and infinite personality, but we hardly regard the reactions associated with the conjectured performances of the deity absolute as personal. Viewed from the personality standpoint and by persons, the eternal Son and the deity absolute appear to be related in the following way. The eternal Son dominates the realm of actual spiritual values, whereas the deity absolute appears to pervade the vast domain of potential spirit values. All actual value of spirit nature finds lodgment in the gravity grasp of the eternal Son, but if potential, then apparently in the presence of the deity absolute. Okay. It's the same, they're saying the same things. They just, that paragraph we just read about the third source and center. Let's do the same thing to it. Okay. The deity absolute. Another one of the seven absolutes. It's just an individuality fact. It's a reservoir of the potential for spirit substance. Okay, but from the unity point of view, instead of the individuality point of view, what do you call, you know, if you look at those facets of deity that are up there in deity and reality, let's just here and pull it out, look at it right here. You know, remember we have the seven absolutes infinity going around the individuality circuit on the outside. There's the deity absolute. What's the facet of deity called? Potential. The infinite potential. That, you know, just like the infinite upholder, that at the infinite level up there, that facet of deity is called the infinite potential. Okay, well, we're talking about this being alongside the absolute spirit. Well, the infinite potential is not immediately alongside, but if I downstep the infinite potential to the absolute potential, okay, then I've got something that's right there with the absolute spirit. The absolute potential. I wonder if that really syncs up with the potentials, since it's called the absolute potential. What did they just say in those two paragraphs? That's what they just said, right? See, it's not the individuality viewpoint reservoir, the deity absolute directly. That's not the actuality that's doing something. That's just a reservoir of potential from the individuality viewpoint. You got to flip it around to the unity viewpoint. What is that called? It's called the absolute potential, and it's right there with the absolute spirit. That's what you more directly think of as an actuality that has this subtle, unpredictable functioning amidst all the spiritual presence of the eternal Son. And what technically is that? That existential fact, when you take everything all the way to the ends of eternity, you've got God the Supreme, fully completed, God the Ultimate, fully completed. You go all the way, you know, beyond eternity to the endless cycles of eternity, and you have God the Absolute. You know that's, you know, you're bringing it all up as an experiential, you know, ever higher experiential phenomenon. And that last culminating event is when it engages the existential. And it becomes existential experiential deity. Yeah, just hold on one second. Okay. That, when you're getting all of it, that last act, that last event, getting God the Absolute, is that absolute potential bonding to that fully experiential fact. And that, again, it's God the Absolute. That's what we're talking about here all the time. That's this absolute potential, the absolute upholder. Different ways of recognizing that in eternity, there's God the Absolute. And down here in time, the fact that there is a God the Absolute, that gets expressed down in here as this subtle presence of the absolute potential, for instance, in this instance. Or here, you know, up where we are again, the subtle presence of the absolute upholder, the co-absolute mind. Okay, this is God the Absolute. That's what we're talking about here. Okay, and to just see all we've done is we've recognized they've told us that when you're ready, don't let our presentation in terms of just the seven absolutes of infinity confuse you. You need to just flip it around into the unity viewpoint that we suggested to you in deity and reality, and then think about it the way makes sense. A reservoir is not doing something. It's just sitting there waiting to be actualized. That viewpoint does not supply the answer to these mysteries of something that's doing something. But from the unity viewpoint, you have the immediate answer. This is God the Absolute. You know, in terms of what we experience, we don't experience this fully integrated fact of God the Absolute. We experience the parts, as it were, you know, the facets of God the Absolute. You know, here influencing spirit, here influencing mind, even over there influencing matter. Remember, must have something to do with that mysterious, unqualified, absolute thing, presence. Remember, every once in a while they're talking about matter and they say this same thing. There's this weird, unpredictable part. Okay. Okay. God the Absolute is God, that mother aspect of God the Absolute is absolute potential in absolute capacity as the absolute upholder. There's three facets. You know, and you see those from the individuality viewpoint as the deity absolute, the unqualified absolute, and the universal absolute. See, more directly, just as absolute to absolute. You know, like if you think about, just 1 second, if you think about that infinite potential, you know, it's like, well, what if I don't have any absolutes yet or anything? If I just, I'm just at the infinite concept of it, and I think, okay, there's a facet of deity, the infinite potential, and if I turn it around, it's a reservoir. But see, the infinite part of that potential for spirit has been actualized. What's it called? The infinite spirit. Okay. So the infinite part has already been taken out. So in terms of just a reservoir, it's just the deity absolute, not the deity infinite. Okay? The infinite part's already been, it's called the infinite spirit. Okay, in terms of a reservoir for mind, the infinite part has already been taken out of you know, what we normally call the universal absolute. It's not the universal infinite. Okay? What is that fact, that infinite fact that's already been taken out? The infinite mind. Yeah? Those are already there. Yeah. And that's why they're called the absolutes, the deity absolute, you know, qualified absolute, universal absolute, because they're not infinite reservoirs anymore. I mean, you can't have them as infinite reservoirs because you know you've already taken out the infinite spirit and the infinite mind. Those aren't potentials. Those are infinite actuals that they know very intimately. Yeah, they were just talking about the infinite mind. Yeah. Right. Well, no, that's the absolute of matter. The cosmos infinite, yes. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, it's fun to just, you know, unpack this a little bit, just so you can better appreciate how to think about it. And it's all right there for you to be teased by if you're noticing. It's like, wait a minute. The universal absolute doesn't function. That's a reservoir. That's just a reservoir of potential. I can't. That doesn't make any sense to think of it functioning. Doing what? Being? No, it's if it's functioning, it's doing. Okay? It's got to be a doingness somehow. Oh. And the only way to understand its doingness is from the unity point of view. Got to flip it around. It's the absolute upholder. Okay. And then we'll get to you, Jason.
Absolutes are more or less a bottom-up viewpoint.
Well, I mean, no. The infinite spirit is an individuality. It's a bottom-up fact. The infinite spirit is an individuality. This is the individuality circuit. It's got things like the infinite spirit in it, the eternal Son. Okay.
So an absolute relates more to a point, to an individuality, whereas the infinite is more of a
right. To understand from what an absolute does for us, that's what you're getting at. See, you know, it's what I was just putting upon. It is the law of that domain. It is the center about which everything must conform. You know, I mean, look at the matter in the master universe. What is it doing? Is it not conforming to the absolute of matter? Every iota of it obeys its command. It is the law of matter. It all goes about it in great ellipses.
And it's the face, okay? It shows to us, that absolute face.
Yeah.
But on the back side of that,
there is the back door, so much.
It's the infinite.
Right.
And the various infinites span out and merge.
Right, it goes all the way up to the Trinity infinite.
Right.
Yeah. But you know, but just you know, and the next, you know, once you start to see that, I mean, you go, you know, you don't go from ultimate to absolute. You go from ultimate to co-absolute, then to absolute, and you don't go right from absolute to infinite either. There's something in between there. The co-infinite. Okay, there's a whole bunch of co-infinite facts and infinite facts of various degrees, it's a big domain up there beyond the absolute.
I understand that in the relationship that I have with spirit, it all seems to be one spirit, but in my mind, I can recognize that there are other facets, right? And I sometimes I need to be reconnected. I feel like I'm unplugged out of the main,
Right. The thing to remember, that about that spirit that you just brought up, and how helpful it is to grab a hold of again, is the unity of it. You know, it is the literal substance that expresses unity. That's why it is so revivifying to engage it. It gets you reintegrated. You need that unity in your life. You need spirit. You can't let the mind just be about the matter, because the matter is individuality and you become fragmented and disjoint and schizophrenic eventually. Okay? You need that spirit to keep you integrated. So when we're talking about deity, and even if we're talking about lots and lots of complicated things, amidst all that complication of absolute potential, infinite potential, on and on and on we go, remember one key fact, the very first thing, and about the only sort of a direct thing they can tell you about deity. What's the fundamental quality of deity?
Unity.
Unity. Just like spirit. So when we're talking about all these facets of deity, when you hear me say deity, so that you don't get lost, immediately when you hear deity, think the unity. We're talking about how everything is one. Like you were just saying, the ministry of spirit is one. But I can, I don't have to let go of that singular, stable fact to remind myself that there's the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Truth, the Thought Adjuster, the angelic ministry. There actually are four things there. I may experience them as a seamless whole, but to begin to appreciate the majesty of this seamless whole that I experience, that it doesn't just happen automatically. It would be automatic if a spirit ministry was just singular, if there was just one spirit ministry in the entire universe, but there's not. There's deity, and spirit ministry is manifold. There's gazillions of it, okay? But it's all, in terms of experientially, it's all one. You experience it as all one. It's like, wow, how cool is that? You know, just to think about that, to let that sink in, what an incredible art you are experiencing, that the creators can engage you in such multitudinous ways, and yet you experience a seamless unity. Okay? Let that, appreciate that. Don't take that for granted. You know, a magical, mystical person just is taking all that for granted. No, recognize there's an individuality to it, and yet you experience it as if there is no individuality. How cool is that? How cool is it that the smartest scientists that have lived can study matter in its deepest details, and there's no hint of the mind, because the mind is so seamlessly integrated with it. How cool is that? That the over control is so perfect. Appreciate that. Don't just take this matter for granted. Remind yourself that this is mind made and personality managed, mind planned, mind made and mind administered. Every single second of every single day, all the time, everywhere, it's all touched and kept in that perfect mode where you'd never know that there were hands on it. How cool is that? Yeah?
all these philosophers that went down this road had a lot of danger, but now, well, there's still, I mean, there's always danger, but now we can go safely down that path of the, what, the infinite eternal ellipse, right?
Well, I mean,
we have a guidebook now.
Right. If you make sure you stay tight to the anchor, I mean, you know, I mean, they know the history. They know how problematic it's been for mankind to try to stretch himself out, you know, and wrap his mind around these big thoughts. He tends to kind of get lost, and lots of fuzzy bizarre stuff, you know, has resulted through the millennia that we call religion in a lot of cases. Yeah, that's the majesty of the book, that it allows you now to engage that stably. But see, only if you have cosmic consciousness still. I mean, spiritual consciousness is never okay in trying to just engage this stuff. It will diffuse out and get lost. Okay? So that's why we spend so much time stressing, you know, identify with the individuality, the anchors here. Hold on solidly to the two ends, the unity and the individuality, and then let yourself set the truth free. You know, the truth is only flows when you have a firm grip on both sides. You can't just get truth to flow out of a grip on spirit. You can imagine it does, but it doesn't actually. Okay? Or vice versa. If you can declare Veritas in your Harvard logo, but if all you have is a grip on matter, there is no Veritas. There is no truth. Okay? You have to hold on to both. You shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. Well, how can I know the truth? You need to firmly grab a hold of both. Then and only then will you feel truth. Is that dynamic experience between individuality and unity, and you'll begin to, your mind will begin to be able to follow that stably. You won't fly off into mysticism or something somewhere.
Deity absolute is the law, and the Trinity as unity and individuality is kind of like our personality on a more infinite level, and by the way they're individual in relationship to the law, they can create infinite variations out of the absolute.
Yeah, I mean, that's the essence of what you're talking about there is how the central universe comes into existence. And it's the pattern for the other universes. Yeah, and that's, you're talking about the absolute persons engaging individuality and allowing all this to unfold. Yeah, very much. All right, let's so thanks for, you know, allowing me to just, you know, take us on that little extended journey there. But you want to do that. I mean, that's the whole point of them giving you, see, I did it, pointing out they did it the previous, they did it again. They're wanting to go, wait a minute, I've read this paragraph before. That's just like, okay, what are they trying to get at here? They want you to try to follow that a little bit.
Certain phases of the unpredictability of finite mind may be due to the incompleteness of the Supreme Being. And there is a vast zone of activities wherein the conjoint actor and the universal absolute may possibly be tangent. There is much about mind that is unknown, but of this we are sure. The infinite spirit is the perfect expression of the mind of the Creator to all creatures. The Supreme Being is the evolving expression of the minds of all creatures to their Creator.
So just again, not only do you have this co-absolute mind in play, but you've got the Supreme Mind, you know, and it's cosmic presence down in the finite, which of course is only going to be manifested in a partial way, because there's a lot of evolution to go yet, but it's there. Little bits and pieces of that encompassing mind of the Supreme. The Supreme Mind encompasses all supreme values. So you'll see subtle things in supreme value, that this coordination. Yep.
Does the Supreme have an existence on Havana?
No, I mean, here, see, we're very much, again, taking a top-down point of view. I mean, there isn't a supreme being now anywhere in the finite. But from a top-down point of view, you do have that being. The supreme being, who's the supreme mind, is there, is an absolute fact, projecting down into the finite that we're experiencing. And, for instance, there's a facet of deity directly that's down in there that we call the supreme. But we also see it in a twofold expression as the Mother and the Almighty, where you can understand those three as superadditive consequences of the relationship between the Mother and the Almighty as the Supreme, like they're just pointing out. Remember how they mentioned how deity is innately minded. In that notion, well, you think of the Supreme Being as the Supreme Mind, and then you bring that down into the finite. As most directly as that facet of deity called the Supreme, well, there's going to be a minded likeness to that reflects the completed fact of the Supreme Mind. And that's what they're, so that's why, you notice that's the way they worded it, a bit there. I mean, it's one, in the one hand, that you're thinking about when all is said and done, we have this Supreme Being, but we don't have that right now. Not even in Havana, not on the Isle of Paradise. You have Majestan on the Isle of Paradise. You have the Universal Mother, the Supreme Spirit, especially in Havana. But not literally the Supreme Being anywhere that you can engage personally. All right, so let's do this one more section, I think. This brings in... a little bit of what they're just teasing at the end there. This whole bit about, and we talked about this up in the Supreme Papers. So let's just preface a little bit before we read this about universe reflectivity. And you see they're gonna bring that out, and it's kind of in a suggestive way because they're a long ways away from the Supreme Papers yet. Here in Paper 9, but let's put the two together a little bit. In a very direct way. When up in the Supreme Papers, when they mention reflectivity in Majestan, that fact of universe reflectivity, in particular, grand universe reflectivity, that is most directly understood, that fact is the cosmic presence, of the Supreme Mind. The Supreme Mind above, the shadow that it casts down in the finite of that encompassment of that Supreme Mind, that all points are touched simultaneously, encompassed by the Supreme Mind, as if they're one point and not a lot of points in a great big grand universe. That ubiquity grand universe reflectivity, that is the cosmic presence of the Supreme Mind. It's a direct expression of that cosmic presence of the Supreme Mind. Okay, that's what it is.
And that would be like the consciousness of something?
Right, and so it had, right. So the consciousness of the Supreme Being, the Supreme Mind. It's a reflection of his consciousness. What is it like to be the Supreme Being and have a consciousness that encompasses all supreme values? Well, it'd be like there is no separation in space or time amongst all finite things. It's like you have your mind wrapped around all of it simultaneously. That's what it's like to think like the Supreme Being. See, so in the same way that, see, again, you can't just look at this from a bottom-up point of view because there is no Supreme Being. Well, if there is no Supreme Being, there is no Majestan because Majestan was created by the Supreme Being. If there is no Supreme Being, there is no universe reflectivity because that's an expression of his consciousness. Yeah. See, I mean, you have to always remind yourself that the individuality point of view immediately comes up short when you start thinking about the details. You know, if you're a celestial being and you know about these details directly, or if they reveal them to you like they have, it's like, well, okay, there it is. Yeah. This whole notion that we're just on this straightaway path to eternity and there's nothing up there yet, you know, tomorrow is not there until I get there. No, it's all there. Yeah. The cosmos infinite is already there. In infinity, not in time, okay. Especially finite time, but you know we're experiencing up through an infinite fact, and the fact that that's what we're doing, and not you know an old fashioned notion of you know the future you know only comes into existence you know when the hand on the clock ticks. Is evidenced by the fact that there's things that are, remember what we called them when we were up there in the Supreme Papers? Antecedent followings, yes. Yeah.
How'd you remember
that? I knew one of the two of you would remember. That's why I was about to say it, and then I wanted to see if one of you would remember. Yeah, antecedent followings, quote unquote. You know, from a purely temporal point of view, they're what follows. The Supreme Being is what follows. But the Supreme Being preceded because this has always been here from the beginning. It's an antecedent following. Yeah. In other words, you got to let go of the time. You got to see it from a top point of view. Right. Okay. Yeah.
With all those other facets of deity and the infinite eternal ellipse, we can recognize that, but we can't recognize the Supreme Being yet, even though we can talk about it, right?
Right.
I thought they said Jesus did.
Now what Michael has done with his seventh bestowal is that supreme type, you know, the type of deity that's called the Supreme, that type of deity is within the finite. He, in going through those seven bestowals, was building up to the point where he could grab a hold of a measure of that. He starts out existentially as father-type deity and son-type deity stuck together and personalized. Then he goes through these seven bestowals and he attaches another type of deity to that self. He has a threefold deity self now of father and son and supreme-type deity together as one. All personalized. That's why he's not just a creator son. That's the two things personalized. The three things personalized as a master son. Okay. So he's taken on a measure of supreme type deity. Not just supremacy lowercase s. Not just the divinity. Okay, but literal supreme type deity. He's a he's God. So he can do that. He literally has a measure of that type of deity, that power personality synthesis type deity, that creature creator unifying type deity, because of course that's what he was doing. Yeah, bringing creature and creator together as one. So once he completed that, he literally has that type of deity as part of him, creature creator unifying deity. So it's in that sense that he has, and then other beings, you know, have that in some measure to begin with. But he acquired that supreme type deity through this experiential process. Okay, so so just notice as we're reading through this, I mean, I won't have to really bring it out then in context, you know, just that's the key fact that you just know. And, you know, they're always very humble. They're saying, well, you know, we're pretty sure we know what Chris just said. Because there doesn't seem to be any other way to explain it. It seems completely logical that that's what it is. But again, it's not like there isn't anyone high that's told them that directly. They're deducing that just like I did, because they gave me everything in the Revelation to be able to deduce that. You know, and so they speak of it that way, just like they always do. It's like, well, we're pretty sure, but you know, or we suspect that. You know, we think that, we believe that. You know, they always say it that way. You know, when they don't have direct experiential knowledge, but that's what's going on.
Universe reflectivity. The conjoint actor is able to coordinate all levels of universe actuality in such manner as to make possible the simultaneous recognition of the mental, the material, and the spiritual. This is the phenomenon of universe reflectivity, that unique and inexplicable power to see, hear, sense, and know all things as they transpire throughout a super universe, and to focalize by reflectivity all this information and knowledge at any desired point. The action of reflectivity is shown in perfection on each of the headquarters worlds of the seven superuniverses. It is also operative throughout all sectors of the superuniverses and within the boundaries of the local universes. Reflectivity finally focalizes on paradise.
Just a couple things there. You notice how they're using the word coordinate and focalize. You know, those are mother words. And they point out the sort of the definitive expression of this in the reflective mother spirits of each super universe. Okay, and then that final anchor point for it all on paradise, in whom? Magizan, right? That's there. Yeah. So, you know, they didn't mention him because they haven't introduced him yet. But yeah. Okay, so the, you know, between the lines, you've got the reflective mother spirits and Magizan. And, you know, this whole is being integral in this phenomenon of bringing supreme the mind down into a cosmic presence and having it become an engageable phenomenon, you know, so that it's not just his consciousness, but others can tap into his consciousness. You know, it's going to take some plug-ins to his consciousness, like reflective mother spirits and reflective image aids and, you know, these various means of plugging into that consciousness, you know, as it is present in the finite.
The phenomenon of reflectivity, as it is disclosed on the super universe headquarters worlds in the amazing performances of the reflective personalities there stationed, represents the most complex interassociation of all phases of existence to be found in all creation. Lines of spirit can be traced back to the sun, physical energy to paradise, and the mind to the third source. But in the extraordinary phenomenon of universe reflectivity, there is a unique and exceptional unification of all three, so associated as to enable the universe rulers to know about remote conditions instantaneously, simultaneously with their occurrence.
This distinction is vital. You're starting to appreciate. See, I mean, you know, like they're saying. I mean, they're saying, just think about it. Okay, the aisle is not going to get this done. The sun's not going to get this done. The absolute mind, you know, the third source center is not going to get this done. There has to be something that is literally able to engage the whole, okay, from within. Okay? So that the whole hierarchy of the mothers has an awful lot to do. And there's a subtle little key to the puzzle that they, you know, only allude to a couple times, you know, that we've filled in. Here's the reflective mother spirits. You know, here's the supreme level, you know, that you could imagine very intimately, directly being connected, you know, to the supreme being. Okay? There's a gap. One is on the second cosmic level, and the other is on the fourth. What fills in on the third level? You know, and that's where you've put in that little piece. Remember, the reflective mother spirits, they're each They're the, you know, they create the mother womb of a super universe. Okay, what on the inside, from the bottom up, is getting so that you have something that's not at, you know, this level two, that's the individual super universe level. This is the collective super universe level. Okay, that's the creative mother agencies of the ancients of the days that they allude to a couple times. And see, those beings are the ones that are, you know, the collective super universe level, so they can immediately synchronize with something that is of the whole grand universe, like the supreme being, the supreme mind, the universal mother, whatnot, are. They're that initial connection, that interface.
So anytime you have individual members, they're not connected to each other.
Except, yes. Right. There's always, yeah. And so this whole process of bringing this down in, you know, comes down through that hierarchy of the mothers, the universal mother, the creative agencies of the ancients of days, the reflective mother spirits, you know, et cetera. And I can say all the way down into the local universe. It's that of those beings, those mother beings that have, that are the individuality of a whole, so they can express something like, or be the agents by which, you know, the agencies, see? Creative agencies, and they can be the agents by which something of the whole can be focalized and plugged into. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, it all ties to that, you know, and that whole bit about why they're the unrevealed creative agencies of the ancients of days. You know, when they say unrevealed, you've got to figure out, well, is it unrevealed because it doesn't have something directly to do with the ascension scheme, which they tell you, you know, that's all they could basically reveal. Or is it unrevealed because it has something to do with the ascension scheme, but they're not allowed to reveal that? Okay. Those, the creative mother agencies of the ancients of days that are at that collective super universe level, what womb are they, you know, for? You know, what you know, they form a womb, obviously, they're mothers. I mean, for what? For what purpose? Well, okay, I get out of the creative mother spirit's womb mind, then I'm in the reflective mother spirit's womb of mind. I get through the whole central universe thing, which is complicated with the, you know, the eternal mother, son, and the infinite mother spirit. But, you know, I'm finally a finaliter. And I go out, I'm not going out back to my super universe where I can kind of go back into the reflective mother spirit's womb of mine. I'm now a citizen of all seven. I'm roaming around all seven. Okay, in what womb of mind am I? That it's like, well, I don't have supreme mind. I mean, I can't be directly in universal mother's womb of mind. I don't have supreme mind. I've got sub-supreme mind, but super universe mind. Who am I plugged into? See, the creative mother agencies of the ancients of the day has created this common womb of mind that you can be plugged into. They're the agencies of the ancients of the days, because the ancients of the days, unlike the master spirits, are not differentiated by super universe. They're common across the seven. They're an expression of commonality across the seven. Okay? And see, they're the unrevealed, because they don't have to do with the ascension scheme. They have to do what happens after the, yeah. They're after the ascension scheme, so they can't be directly revealed. But they have to be mentioned. All these things that are unrevealed or just whatever, I mean, they have to be mentioned, because if they don't mention them, you can't put the pieces together. You'll start constructing charts and tables and whatnot when you start. It's like, I got to sort this out. And you start sticking things in boxes, and you go, wait a minute, there's a gap here, there's a box that's blank, and there has to be something in there. Oh, that's those guys, you know, that's the, you know, unqualified vicegerents of, you know, of the ultimate. That's what those crazy guys are. They go and, you know, I mean, that's what you start to do. You just start discovering, every time you try to put something together, every time you try to make a table like this, where almost everything on there is very straightforward to just plug in, there's an empty box on the table. And you go, what the heck goes in there? And then you go, oh, that's why that's in there, unrevealed and everything. They have to tell you it so that you know what to stick in the box, and then you can start to put some of the pieces together.
Okay. I just wanted some clarity. Mm-hmm. After the ascension scheme, mm-hmm. really what I interpret you saying is after this life on the ascension scheme.
No, after the ascension scheme.
Post-finality.
When you're a finaliter. After paradise.
Okay, and then I got another question. Mm-hmm. Also, it could be a combination or information that would be revealing the next age of revelation to our planet.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I mean, sometimes they can't reveal stuff because it's getting ahead of the game. It has a lot to do with the ascension scheme, but it's getting ahead of the game. Other times, the only reason it's unrevealed is just because it's about what you do as a finaliter, not what you do as an ascender.
Shadow cast by the stencil of the things they can't reveal.
Just, if it's in here, if they mention some mysterious being in here, it's because if you try to start putting the pieces together, you're going to find a box that's blank. Okay. Every single box that you could find with what they've given you very up front, every box that you can find in putting that together that's blank, they've revealed that name or that being or that fact somewhere in here. It may be just in a list, like the lesser angels, the ones that are below cherubim. Okay. But it has to be in there somewhere because if you try to start putting this together, you're going to notice, wait a minute, okay? They've given you a complete picture. It's just that sometimes they have to be very limited in what they can say about some of the puzzle pieces, okay? But they've given you every puzzle piece. There's no blank boxes in any picture that any of us could draw for the next 1,000 years. All right.
Much of the technique of reflectivity we comprehend, but there are many phases which truly baffle us. We know that the conjoint actor is the universe center of the mind circuit, that he is the ancestor of the cosmic mind, and that cosmic mind operates under the dominance of the absolute mind gravity of the third source and center. We know further that the circuits of the cosmic mind influence the intellectual levels of all known existence. They contain the universal space reports, and just as certainly they focus in the seven master spirits and converge in the third source and center. The relationship between the finite cosmic mind and the divine absolute mind appears to be evolving in the experiential mind of the Supreme. We are taught that in the dawn of time, this experiential mind was bestowed upon the Supreme by the Infinite Spirit, and we conjecture that certain features of the phenomenon of reflectivity can be accounted for only by postulating the activity of the Supreme Mind. If the Supreme is not concerned in reflectivity, we are at a loss to explain the intricate transactions and unerring operations of this consciousness of the cosmos. Reflectivity appears to be omniscience within the limits of the experiential finite and may represent the emergence of the presence consciousness of the Supreme Being. If this assumption is true, then the utilization of reflectivity in any of its phases is equivalent to partial contact with the consciousness of the Supreme.
See, so you see the way they word it, just like I said. I mean, and you can appreciate, I mean, the existence or the manifestation of Magistan, remember what they say about that? It's like, whoa, where did that come from? That came out of the blue. And we know there's going to be a whole bunch of things, they say, the closer the grand universe gets to being settled in light and life, there's going to be a whole bunch of things that no one anticipated that are suddenly going to begin to manifest. So because they know how much they don't know, they're always very qualified in the way they talk about something like this when they really try to step out. It's like, but at the same time, you know, they practically say, but, you know, we'd be really surprised. I mean, it just seems so immediately obvious that this is what it is, that it would be something that we currently have no clue about. If it's not the supreme mind, if it's the Glorpglick, you know, they're going to be really surprised. Because the supreme mind just seems a very immediate, logical way to understand it. You know, and so, you know, the very fact that they present it this way is really giving us a license to take it as a solid working idea. I mean, more than just working hypothesis, but really working idea. You know, they're basically telling you, you're not going to come up with any better working idea. We guarantee you, we haven't. So just go with this like we do. Use it as a way to get your hands on this fact of reflectivity, understand it, and start being able to, you know, not think of it as some magical, mystical thing. You know, even though, just experientially, it is pretty magically, mystically, like, cool. You know, that you can stand, you know, on your versus, say, and get a presentation to you as it, with absolutely no difference than as if you were standing on the, you know, headquarters of some other super universe. You know, it's not just the next best thing to being there. It's exactly like being there. The fact, you know, like they're saying, where was that? Where they brought up the hearing, seeing, where in the heck is that line? Hell, here, see, hear, sense, and know all things as they transpire throughout a super universe. Well, not even that, you know, more than that, throughout the grand universe, the whole grand universe, as if you were a consciousness that was ubiquitously present and knowing and seeing and hearing throughout every square inch of the grand universe.
In a sense, they're telling us of a way to know those things that we don't know. Meaning, not that we know them, but it's like when you're putting a puzzle together.
Yeah.
If you have boundaries,
mm-hmm.
you know that the puzzle pieces fit in a boundary. Or if you, then when you find a puzzle piece, if you have a picture to look at,
yeah.
you have an idea of where to place it.
Yeah. yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of what they're giving us, is
yeah.
A boundary and an idea of what it should look like. So when you find a piece, you have an idea of where to put it.
Right. But what you're saying there, you know, is a key point. That's what you're trying to do. That's the whole point of spending any time studying this revelation. It's so that not only you finally get the framework put together in your mind so that all of the pieces in here have a place to go. But there's a lot of things that aren't in here. There's all the pieces that are out here in your day-to-day life. And people live chaotic, disorganized lives because they have no way to take these pieces and put them into any framework and understand them. And, but you know how much I love the revelation for what it's been able to do in this regard. By getting myself reformed into this framework, it's just amazing how you can hear things, you know, in the outer world that you really have never studied, have no direct relationship with, but you're exposed to them, and it's like, oh, well, I know where that piece goes. You can immediately help a person understand this thing more than they who have been working on it for years understand it. You just know. You have the insight to show them what they're missing, and just it's like, oh no, turn it like that, you know, because you know where it's supposed to go. You know it's a puzzle piece, and you know it's not oriented like this. It's oriented like this because you see the picture, you know, and trees are oriented this way in the picture, not this way, you know. And so you know how to orient the puzzle piece, or they don't, because they don't see, they don't have that objective point of view. Yeah.
I was watching on the internet in real time the running of the torch, the Olympic torch, through England. And they had a bus in front of whoever was running it at the time. You know, the ability to be there when something is happening on the other side of the world, so far away, and you're literally there in the guy's face.
Right, and they mentioned the, you know, you take what you're just describing, you take it up to their level, and you have, they contain the universe space reports. You know, you have the broadcasts, you know, that are doing on high what we're trying to begin to do, you know, connect point A to point B, but there's time involved. Right. You know, there's a time lag between Great Britain and here. Reflectivity just takes it up the next notch. It connects point A to point B with no time lag, you know. And also no 1/r². You know, no diffusing of the thing. There's a star, but it's kind of dim because it's really far away. No, you see the star as if you're standing right in front of the star, not as if its light has gone across hundreds and hundreds of light years and diffused out, you know, into a sphere.
Sometimes if I have to find something in the back of my head to relate to it or connect in a new way, I think of a song. And the only song I can think of is a U2 song that says, "Even better than the real thing." How can that be true?
Yeah, well, I mean, a higher objectivity is better than a lower, real, yes, but lower perspective. You know, it's, you know, that's the betterness, you know.
A statement like that is like saying it's what I didn't say that you have to find the truth of, right? Isn't that what...
No, just, you know, that better than the real thing. I mean, just think about the concept of the real thing. How limited our initial point of view of what reality is. You know, there's an initial thing that you say, oh, this is real. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if someone has an experience like, wow, this is real, man. Okay, yeah, it's like we have no idea how real an experience can be. There's experiences that are a lot better than our quote-unquote real thing. Okay, that's what that notion is getting at. It's tied. I mean, it's a good point because we bring that up a lot. It's very important when you're engaging the revelation to not engage it in that quote-unquote real way that you've always engaged life. That old wineskin. And don't pour the revelation into your old notion of reality. You know, twist it and, you know, wrench it and cram it and pry it and make it fit into your old quote-unquote reality. Forget about your old reality because it's not real. Okay, let go of it. The reality is much more satisfying. You know? And it'll finally allow you to get unstuck in your life, to not be always being caught off guard by the next seemingly random puzzle piece that comes flying at you out of nowhere. Okay. Was Jesus like that? No, he was never caught off guard. He had the whole big picture. He could take whatever came at him. Okay. We can have that presence. He didn't do that because he's God. He did that because he's true man. And we can do that too if we take delight in cultivating that ability. There's nothing better than working on this first, getting your mind wrapped around this. You don't have to wrap your mind around all of this. You know, you just begin to wrap your mind around a little chunk of this, and immediately you'll start to notice it transforms your day-to-day life. Suddenly, a whole bunch of things that were mysterious are not mysterious anymore. It just happens naturally. You know, and if you want to expand that, expand your relationship to this. And then seek first, okay? Then this. More of this will not help you understand this. Trying to, you know, read everything that's on the internet is not going to help you understand this. Trying to read every great book, every philosopher, it's not going to help you understand this. this, then read the great philosophers, and you might be able to get something worthwhile out of them.
Yeah. I am, therefore.
Okay. All right, so so the next time we'll finish this up, the personalities of the infinite spirit, and then we'll roll over into the Paradise Trinity. undoubtedly get us into some interesting spaces, because you know that even to begin to understand the Trinity, you can't do the individuality point of view. Yeah.
So,
this is a divine counselor. Yeah, this one is a divine counselor. A divine counselor. Yeah, yeah. All these first ones are divine counselor. All right, let's take a moment here.